Meditation would be a lot easier if we could just start at zero. If we could just give some instruction and then we would do what the instruction is about. That would be rather simple and rather easy. The practical experience teaches us something different. Much of what is difficult in meditation is not what we don't know how to do, but what we are already doing. The truth is, mind, and in Buddhist psychology this is very clear, mind is activity. Intentional forces are operative on many levels, on the level of perception, on the level of affect, what's happening in our heart, on the level of cognitive process, how we think about what's happening, the way we communicate, and what we do with our will. All this is possibly distorted. It is, in the best possible situation, it is a process of doing. Mind means doing. Thinking is doing. Perceiving is doing. Emoting is doing. So we keep doing things. The problem is, many of the things we do, we don't actually notice. We don't know that we're doing this. We think it's happening. It's just happening to me. Or I'm absolutely innocent. Or worse, I'm the victim. I'm the victim of a world that operates not like I wish it to operate. So one of the first steps as meditators is we take responsibility. We take responsibility for the states we experience. We take responsibility for the images that occur. We take responsibility for how we feel. Now, taking responsibility is very different from making a self out of my experience. If I make a self out of my experience, that means if I have an angry thought, then I become an angry person. Even if the thought has gone, I'm still an angry person. I have a problem because I don't like to be an angry person. Because I have angry thoughts, I become an angry person. And even the problem has gone, I still have an identity I have created. Now in Buddhist teaching, this is considered very, very painful. In fact, even if you don't like Buddhist concept, it's still very, very painful. So, taking responsibility for our experience doesn't mean becoming my experience. It doesn't mean if you have angry thoughts that you then become an angry person, but it means I am taking responsibility that the anger that is manifest in my mind doesn't go out. If I can't help experiencing it, at least I'm not going to amplify it. I don't give him a loudspeaker. I am willing to experience the anger within the mind, within the heart, rather than looking for somebody to blame, and then attributing my anger outside and projecting my anger to a person or to a thing or to a situation which I declare responsible. So the honest meditator, the honest contemplative, takes responsibility that the place where anger manifests is in the heart. It can then go to the mind, and if we're not careful, it can go out to our world, into our relational world. Usually anger is about other people. So taking responsibility means owning our anger. It means I know the anger grows here, and I'm not going to justify being angry with other people. You see, anger is a good example, because as long as there is desire in the mind, there is also anger in the mind. Desire and anger are qualities of mind that fall away very late in the practice. It's the very last stage before you become an absolute saint, that anger and greed stop. So, you know, the measure is pretty high. It's pretty lofty. So it's a common everyday experience. Are you still with me there? Okay. Owning. So, is it possible? Tricky. I wonder. Please come back, microphone. Sometimes it helps. So, I'd like to invite you to follow me for a few thoughts on this, because it is crucial that we distinguish between having an experience and becoming this experience. Yeah, there is a big, crucial difference. And one thing that helps me to make that difference is that I create a space, yeah, that my sati, my presence of mind, opens up a space in which things are allowed to happen, even unpleasant things. And while they happen in that space, I don't become these things, but they occur. While they have something to do with my past and my history and the way I live, it's not the case that these things are eternal. I see a hand there, huh? We've lost the loudspeakers again. Please come back again. So one of the things, as a meditator, I'm interested, please. One of the things I'm interested as a meditator is creating that space. How can I create that space? Well, let's try without. Creating that space means taking away the things that obstruct such a space. The things that obstruct the space are memories, are my thoughts, is the history I have of myself. So much of meditation practice for me has become to mean opening spaces in the heart, opening spaces in my experience for things to be the way they are. That doesn't mean I affirm the way they are, or I think it is good the way it is, but it means before I can change, before something can change, there has to be enough space for it to be received. So if you start a meditation, it is important that we are clear what's in the channel, how much material is floating, what are my thoughts, what are my emotions, what is my physical state. The Buddha made this very clear. He spoke of four foundations of mindfulness. Think of those foundations as of TV channels. Like with TV channels, all the messages, all the frequencies are always there. Yeah. Right now in this air you have many TV waves and many radio waves. What we need is the right channel. Different channels have different messages. They're all equally valid, but not equally useful. So for meditators we want the body channel, because it is the slowest. It is in some ways the most reliable. It is the one we can easily put our attention to, because it's concrete, it's tangible. That's why we do body awareness practice. That's why we start with posture. Can you hear me there at the back? is okay like this. Creating a space means letting go of things. That's what creates most space. Letting go of how it was yesterday, of who I think I am, of who I think I should be, of what so-and-so said, who I am, or what I should be. That all needs to be put down. That's probably one of the most difficult bits. Putting down, really, all the good things you have learned so hard.
Yeah.
All the good things you have invested effort in getting competence and expertise and knowledge. All these things you need to put down, at least for a moment, so that that space opens up again. Remember the image of the clearance I spoke. We don't know what's coming there. So we need to arrive at that place of clearance. And to clear things means letting them go. So meditators need to leave the luggage at the door. As we leave the shoes at the door, we leave our luggage at the door. Our families, our jobs, all the things that are dear and precious. We don't say we're never going to see them again. That's not the point. We're going to pick them up again when we go out. That's what we do with the shoes. So I don't want you to leave your families behind. That's not my message. But the message is that right now you help your family best by being completely here. And by being completely here means you attend to very simple, direct, immediate experiences. Body, what's happening in your thinking, what's happening in your heart, what is your attitude to these things. Creating space also means looking at some of my expectations. One of the things that takes space away is expectation. I'd like to speak about a particular expectation. In Buddhist meditation circles, unfortunately, it is called concentration. Now, I don't know what the word concentration does to you. It has an unpleasant felt sense to me. I think when I speak of concentration, I think of wringing something, yeah? Taking something and in concentric movement squeezing it. The Buddhist word for what we call concentration in many languages in the West, sadly, has a very different feel to it. The Buddha speaks of that quality in different images, in different words. One such word is samadhi, which means it is something that has come together, that has been put together, that has collected itself. So in many ways, the word collectedness of mind is better than concentration of mind. Another way this Buddha speaks of such collectedness is ekagata. It means the mind has become one-pointed. Another way, a very powerful verbal image for that state of mind is ekodibhava. It means the mind has become unified. The image of that unification is the image of water. Think of water you pour into a vessel. And that water is very, it adapts to the shape of the vessel. It doesn't have corners or edges. The great thing about water is it takes the shape of whatever container it is in. If you put in 3 drops of water, they don't sit in the corner and say, I have nothing to do with the other guy over there. Yeah, there's a cohesive quality in water. Yeah. So the image of a mind that collects itself is the image of water. There's a cohesive quality. The truth is, the mind likes this. It actually likes doing this. It likes concentrating. It likes getting unified. Yeah. This is something that is greatly pleasurable to the mind. If you have experienced collectedness of mind, you will know what I speak of. It's very blissful. It's very healing. Unfortunately, it's conditioned. It can stop. When the conditions cease, the collectedness of mind also tends to stop. So we can not always live there. If you have experienced this, you would like to live there. Collectedness of mind can be an object of great attachment. This doesn't speak against it. Yeah. We can, in fact, attach at almost anything in the world. I would be very happy if people only attached to the nice thing in their life. But as somebody who speaks with people a lot and is with people a lot, I'm conscious that we can attach at the most horrible things. You know, I'm a failure. I'm a loser. I'm a victim. You know, we can attach to such roles. They make us perfectly miserable, and still we can attach to them. So concentration and attachment to concentration, in my experience, is a very minor problem. It's unfortunate if you have it, but in fact, you're fortunate if you have enough concentration to attach to, because our world is a crazy world. And crazy worlds produce a lot of impingement on our senses. And the result of that impingement is that our energy goes out. It goes out through the senses, and it is literally distracted. Yeah? It is dispersed. It is fragmented. It goes out through the senses and plays with things. An individual gratification is nice, but it doesn't last very long, and it leaves us hungry. It leaves us with a deep and profound sense of longing somewhere in our hearts. So samadhi, collectedness of mind, is a way not just to still the mind as a practical instrument, but it is also a way of coming home to a happiness that doesn't depend on sense gratification from outside. It doesn't depend on the fridge, on the television, on appreciation, on nice things to see, eat, touch, and be in. It is a capacity of the heart to find a happiness that lives within. That's very powerful, and it's totally counterintuitive, I must say. This world, I think Israel is no different from Switzerland or Germany or America, or in fact Tibet, Thailand, or anywhere else, is no different insofar as the major suggestion in our societies is happiness comes from outside. Happiness comes from getting what I wish, getting what I want, getting what I need. And it is true. Some of happiness comes from there, that's true. And sometimes it's even spectacular happiness. There are very subtle forms of suffering, as the Buddha would say. But there is something in the heart that remains unquenched, that keeps being lonely or longing. Samadhi, collectedness of mind, can help us to make the heart still, to make the heart blissful. It can bring in contrast suddenly the gratification we can experience from our outer senses. That is one of the major functions of samadhi. It's not just useful for insight meditation, it's also useful because it gives us a reference for our other happiness. If we have experienced the happiness of a heart that is collected, we get a perspective on the happiness we get from strawberries, from sex, from whatever you like to fill into the blank now. Yeah. So please be clear, the Buddha didn't say these things are bad or immoral. All he said, there is a longing in our hearts that cannot be quenched by things we can experience through our senses. That longing is deep down in human beings. By my understanding, it is as deep down as the curiosity and to learn, and as the wish to live in a meaningful world, and obviously the wish to be free and to be happy in this world. So, collectedness of mind is a very useful thing. The problem is the mind that wants this as an object is very unpeaceful. So we have a little paradox here. Meditators want to be peaceful and happy, and while trying to be peaceful and happy, they get all uptight, crabby, and stressed, yeah? And frustrated if it doesn't work. You know, Buddhism is great. I've given it 2.5 days. It hasn't worked. So, sorry. Next one, please. Consider these teachings come from a background that speaks of deep wisdom, that speaks of profound existential values. Otherwise, Buddhism wouldn't be around if it wouldn't touch deep down into an existential realm of experience Buddhism would have been a fad of the 6th century BC and it would have been gone and long over. But because there is a profound truth in what the Buddha spoke of in human experience, that is still valid, although we can fly to the moon and we can download all kind of things and we'll be flying to the Mars soon and so forth. Some things haven't changed. Human beings still get born, still die. Human beings still get ill. Human beings experience anger and frustration. Human beings are capable of learning. That is still true. Human beings are capable of being free. That is still true. Nothing has changed in 2,500 years. So it's important you understand this. And the teachings that come out of this tradition, they're pitching their level at liberating the human heart. This is a lifetime program, just to be clear. It's not a weekend program. Buddhist meditation has very nice side effects. It's brilliant at stress reduction. It has proven validity for people with anxiety, with depression, with pain. All this is a side effect of Buddhist meditation. It's not what the Buddha was about. You know, the Buddha wasn't about samsara management, as I would call it. Yeah, as a sort of socially acceptable way to handle my drives or something like this. This was not what the Buddha's teaching is about. It's about big things. It's about getting human beings from bondage to freedom. This is his vision. So that's where these teachings come from. What you do with this teaching is yours. Yeah. If you are interested in stress reduction, fine. Come here and I'll teach you what I know and what I have to share, and you do your stress reduction with this. My vision is, I'm a Buddhist. I'm a disciple of the Buddha. More so than anything, I was a monk for a long time, and I've never been really a monk as a profession. I was always a disciple of the Buddha. I stopped being a monk and I'm still a disciple of the Buddha. So this is what I'm in for. I'm in for the big business. There are many things you can take from what I say, and you could put it into your job, you can put it into your family life. This is quite possible to integrate this into many things. But understand that there is a depth to it, and that depth asks something from you. It asks that you take a risk. It asks that you give it space. It asks that you give it your intelligent consideration. So it is crucial that you keep that as a background if we speak of specific exercises. I spend much of my time teaching people the value of meditation practice, and I help people who meditate. Some have just begun and some are doing this for 20 years. I try to help these people, but I have also to tell you, you can sit for years on your cushion without understanding anything if you don't use your head, your intelligence and your heart. You know, if this stops in here, it will have a very limited effect on your life. If we don't look at the rest of the Buddhist teaching, for example, your valid meditation experience are likely to be interpreted back down into models of thinking that are not very useful. Anything that operates with a model of personality is likely to reinforce the problem. So, please bear with me if we speak not just of specific meditation exercises. If I'm not teaching tricks here, this has reasons. I come from a background where meditation is not a technique. Ajahn Chah, who is famous for not teaching techniques, has always insisted that the contemplative mind is an attitude. It's not a trick. It's not a method. It's not a technique. I have great respect for method, tricks and techniques, but none of them will get you enlightened. You only get an improved version of yourself, which is still going to be suffering, which is still going to grow old, which is still going to die. So the freedom lies in understanding the nature of our experience, and that can happen at any moment if we are prepared to look at this experience in an open, in a fresh, and in a committed way. Yeah. commitment is a big thing. It means we have to give up things. To be here, we have to give up being in many other places we could be. To do this, it means we have to give up many other things we could do right now. That's the same if you run a business, if you have a clinical practice, if you raise a family, if you make your first million. You know, commitment means giving up things. It's important that you acknowledge the validity of this truth, that doing something well means giving up many other things. So if we come here and sit, meditate, we have to give up all the things we could think of, all the fantasies we could hold, all the lists, the yellow label lists we could tick off right now. We have to give this up and say, how do I feel? How does this body feel? Can I be with a body breathing? Is this enough for my attention? Or do I demand more entertainment? I lower, that is the radicalness of mindfulness meditation, I lower the threshold of intensity my experience has to have before I give my attention. Usually I go into a situation and I look, where is the most activity? Where is most happening? That's where my attention goes. If there's nothing happening, I'm bored. You know? I say, well, there's nothing happening here. Or it's boring. It means I'm not attentive enough. Boredom always means I'm not really attending. Boredom means I expect something to happen at this intensity, but in fact, it's only that subtle or that slow or that discreet. Being a meditator means you don't demand entertainment. You don't blame your experience on other people. If people open or close windows, have nylon trousers which make funny noises, you don't blame your aversion on their trousers. Yeah. You take responsibility for your aversion and you hope that they give up their trousers. Or you speak to the manager. Right, yeah. But you take responsibility for your aversion. You know it is aversion. If it says, I am right, I am right, I am right, you can be sure it's not right. You can be sure it's generally anger or aversion. So you know aversion how it is. What do you do with it? Rather than be self-reproachful and say, I'm a good Buddhist, I shouldn't have aversion, I've been meditating for so many years, still aversion. That doesn't help. You go to the body and feel, how does aversion feel in the body? Where do I feel this? You know gradually how the body feels in its different states. Where do you feel tiredness? Well, how does it feel in the body to be tired? Would you know right now? How would you recognize tiredness?
Heaviness.
Heavy, yeah. How do you know that you're tired?
Eyes.
Other voices.
Hard to concentrate.
Hard to concentrate.
Body hurts.
Body hurts. Yeah.
Restless.
Restless. Good, good start. Yeah, there's a few other things. Thoughts are dreamy. Body may rock. Breathing is heavy and labored. You know, there's many other symptoms. These are symptoms that may be specific to you. So it's important you know your body when it is tired. You know your body when it is angry. You know your body when it is happy. So being with the aversion in the body is much easier than being with the aversion if it is in the head. If you think with the aversion, you think of other situations where you were aversed, where other people have done things to you that made you aversed. And I could go back a long time. And at the end, you don't know what started the process, but you're still aversed 6 hours later, there, seething with people who had made noise 10 years ago in another retreat. And the only constant experience is ongoing aversion in your heart, which happens right now, right here. Instead of that, the suggestion is for the meditator Acknowledge the emotional state. Take responsibility for the emotional state by going to the body and feeling, where is the root? Where is the bodily anchor of that experience? Can I stay mindfully there? Now again, this is against our habits. The habit would be, if it's painful there, I go away. I go somewhere else where it's interesting. So generally, it's interesting in the head. Yeah. If you're in a meditation retreat, nothing else goes on, so you go to the head. Yeah. There's many pleasant memories, or many fantasies you can engage with. Instead, the meditator goes to the place where it hurts, it goes to the aversion in the body. Rather than thinking about it, you feel it. That's why Kaya Nupassana, this body, is so important. That's why we keep switching back from channel X to channel 1. Body, sensation, how it is, embodied reality to be with. When you do that with your aversion, when you stay mindful, really present with the physical sensation of an aversive emotion, within 2 minutes this aversion will have subsided. I guarantee, 3 minutes maximum. You see, aversions are very impermanent. And if you don't feed them with ideas, with memories, with thoughts, with plans, what you're going to tell them, you know, how irresponsible this meditation business with nylon trousers, how can you think? Yeah. You're going to really let him have it when you come out here, you know, there's no question about it. Once you stop all this and just stay with the burning, itching, restless, constrained emotion somewhere at the pit of your stomach that produces aversion in my system, what it is for you, you have to find out yourself. Once I'm willing to bear with that, it will stop very quickly because it's not fed. The tiger not fed will die. Yeah. That's the trick of body meditation. It can help you come back very, very quickly into an immediate presence. It gives you very practical tools. You can do that with anxiety, day or night time. You can do that with fear, loneliness, frustration. Go to the body. If you're in a formal meditation situation, if you are in danger of being overwhelmed by emotional state, acknowledge the emotion, go to the body, and be prepared to be with the unpleasantness of that bodily experience. And that experience will very quickly diminish. It may not be gone forever. You know, it may flare up 30 seconds later. It's not completely liberated, but you have a means of reducing your emotion, your pain. So please be aware of this possibility when we speak of body exercises. If we go back to deepening our awareness of the breath, consider our tools. First three forms of Kaya Nupassana is posture and orientation in space. If you want to build a collectedness of mind that is a solid basis for your meditation practice, you need to be able to feel the body. The more differentiated your body sensations are, the more capable you are to be with a big body space, the more diverse your ability is to move your attention through the body, the better your chances to get a good samadhi, to get good unified mind experience. Samadhi that is based on mental phenomena, disembodied phenomena, is very likely to fritter away. It's very likely to break. You cannot really build a healthy type of collectedness of mind on something that isn't embodied. So the first thing to learn is how to be continually aware of the embodied space. The space in which I breathe, the space in which the sensations of this body occur. That's my first object of meditation. Sometimes you can do that big, generic, yeah. There's a huge space and you feel different things in there. Sometimes you are going to be very particular. You have tiny spaces you are investigating. We need more time for this. But the first step, feeling the body in a continual and in a way that allows the space to grow. We don't want a tiny space. We want a space in which the whole of our body experience can take place. We do that with breathing. That's the second part of Kaya Nupassana Anapanasati. Yeah, the mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out. You establish various qualities of that breath. You ask after these qualities. The one that helps me most is, how deep down does the breath go? Because the lower the breath goes, generally the more relaxed you are. The lower part of your breathing apparatus, which is your belly, your diaphragm, is producing a quite tangible, quite big sensations. Yeah. So in many ways, this is the easiest place to start with. And then you establish, that's crucial, you establish your awareness at that place. You don't follow the breath out and back in and back out. That's not what you do. The image is the image of a saw cutting wood. Imagine if you, old style saw, you know, you're sawing wood like this. And you put your attention to the place where the blade hits the wood. You don't follow the blade up like this, yeah? You don't do this. You stay with your attention or awareness at one place where the saw hits the wood, and that's where your attention rests. In the same way, you decide on an area of your body where you establish your attention. If you haven't chosen, choose the belly. Choose something that is not too small. To start with, use something that is maybe as big as both of your hands. So as if you would weigh the breath. Every breath that comes, you kind of receive it with both hands and you feel it. Find out, this is very personal, and I'm speaking with many people here at one go, so find out what it is like. For me, it is like this kind of movement often. And then you feel the ramifications of that movement going out into the belly. Now, there are times when I want the big, the whole movement. When I'm tired or when I'm new in a place, I need grounding. Yeah? I want things to be big, to be solid, to be stable, to be concrete. When my concentration is strong, I make the space more small. I try to make it more fine. It's crucial that you learn to understand what your needs are. They may be differing. This morning it was very silent when we sat. Yesterday morning everybody was fidgeting around. It was impossible with you. Yeah? This morning we didn't even do standing meditation. You were so good I didn't ring the bell. I thought, they're all fine. Let's just continue sitting. So things change. Yeah? You are not the same person as yesterday. I've seen that many, many times. So learn what are your needs immediately. There is a time when we need to collect our minds with big objects of meditation, when we're tired or when we're sleepy or when we're upset. There's a time when the mind is quite malleable, quite mobile. We can be much more refined. We may want to go to the breath at the nose or in the heart region, and we stay there because it's more subtle. The next step, you learn to follow. You learn to make the experience of breathing longer. Now, you don't make the breath longer. You try to make the awareness of the breath longer. That's different. The breath is fine as it is. You don't try to change the breath. You change your way to be with the breath. So first of all, generally the beginning of the in-breath is the easiest. That's the strongest sensation. So this is what you notice, you know, it's okay, beginning, 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 and then beginning and, yeah, a stretch, however long it's possible. And then you add beginning and ending. And then you start the beginning of the beginning, middle of the beginning, end of the beginning. So you stretch this moment of breathing, you stretch it out, and you try to become continually aware of what's happening, not just when the sensations are strongest, but can you actually be with the sensation while it ends? Can you be aware when it has ended? Can you be aware of the space after it has ended? Yeah. So at this stage, we would practice continuity in our awareness. The third big part of Kaya Nupassana is Sampajanya practice. It means that we take the meditation exercise outside of the hall. Rather than just watching the breath when we sit on our meditation cushions, we also move mindfully. We are conscious if the body moves. We're conscious that we enter a door, that we enter a room, that we leave a room. We're conscious that we move stairs. We are bringing the mindfulness to the body while the body is doing things, moving. That doesn't mean you function from now on only in slow motion. Yeah, this is not what we're trying to do. Ajahn Chah always used to laugh at Burmese meditation speed. There is good reason for slowing down, because it helps us to be more precise. One of the problems with mind is so much is happening at the same time. So slowing down gives us a better chance to actually acknowledge what is happening. But we can't live our lives in slow motion. If this, what we're doing here, is going to have any value in your life, you need to find ways to integrate this in your life. So breath is something we keep doing. Whether you're here or not, I trust you'll be breathing outside of meditation retreats. So returning to the breath with our attention in any situation is likely to make us more real, is likely to make us more honest what's happening. So please take that with you. Sampajanya practice, which means knowing things thoroughly, is something that has body reference. Running up a stair, feeling your body. You will run up that stair differently. Smoking a cigarette, knowing your body, you will smoke that cigarette differently. Cooking a meal, catching a bus. There's so many ways you can become consciously and bodily aware of what's happening. All this will help your formal meditation practice. So for today, which is the last day of our weekend retreat, try to prolong awareness with a thing. If you're in formal meditation practice, that thing, I suggest, is the sensations of your breathing at the point you have determined. If you're doing something else, try to prolong your awareness on taste, for example, when you eat. When you eat, generally, you want to eat the first bite. And then when the first bite is over, you actually think already of the next bite. You're still chewing, yeah? But actually you want the next bite. The meditative exercise would be to try to stay with the taste of the first bite rather than think about the next bite. Will the next bite be also as good? Or maybe I get that bit over there which looks a bit better. Yeah. So you try to stay with things. That's how we train mindfulness in time, is we staying with things. That's how we learn. Stay. See what's happening. Stay. Does it really become like I thought it would become, or is it going to be different? Any duration in our awareness is going to produce miracles, is going to produce insights, is going to produce space. So please experiment with this. Come back to your body, irrespective of how many times you drift away, fantasize, you get distracted, come back. And do not consider this a failure. Every time you come back to your breath means that you have been mindful enough to acknowledge that you have disappeared from your object. It's mindfulness which helps you come back. Yeah. knowing that you have drifted away, that you're thinking, fantasizing, is already mindfulness. It's not failure. And every time you come back, you weaken the habit of distraction. So please do not judge yourself. It is normal that the mind strays. Just come back. No fuss, no big scene, no big failure, no judgment. This is what the mind does. It's like a child. It likes to play. Yeah, my mind does. So you bring it back. You try to make it curious for what's happening here. I think you have plenty of advice, plenty of things at hand. Please practice well for today. Yeah? Let's sit for a quarter of an hour.